Hey everybody, it's Britt, lead pastor at Sunridge. Welcome back to our teaching podcast. You know, we are on a mission here at Sunridge to help people find and follow Jesus. We believe in the good news that Jesus welcomes all, regardless of how far you feel from God. That means we're a great starting point to explore Christianity or to sink your spiritual roots deep as a devoted Jesus follower. If you'd like to know more about us, just check out our website at sunridgechurch.org. And of course, we'd love to have you drop in anytime for a visit to learn and worship along with us. And now, here's our teaching for this week. Have you guys heard of Rockin' 1000? It's a band. They're now dubbed the largest band in the world. And they're originally organized in 2015 as a way to entice the Foo Fighters to hold a concert in Cesena, Italy. And have you seen them? I don't know. You're going to see them. I'm just going to cue the screen and let you see a little piece of what they do. Isn't that awesome? So to be precise, Rockin' 1000 actually has 1,002 musicians and singers, includes hundreds of guitarists, bass players, drummers, keyboardists, and singers, as well as wind and string instruments. And in addition to Learn to Fly, which we just watched, they've covered songs by Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin, Depeche Mode, AC/DC, The Rolling Stones, and even John Lennon. And I just think it's remarkable how they could orchestrate all those musicians and singers together to do this thing. But Rockin' 1000, I'm going to tell you, isn't nearly as impressive as the collaborative worship gathering that Nehemiah organizes to celebrate the final completion of the city walls around Jerusalem. And if you're just joining us or, you know, you haven't been paying attention, for the last 14 weeks, we're nearly at the end of this study of these two Old Testament books, Ezra and Nehemiah. Together, we've said, they tell the story of the Jewish people returning to their homeland after falling to Babylon in 605 BC. Remember, they were conquered and exiled from their land by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon at that time. And we're just about 100 years later than when this whole thing started. After 70 years of captivity, just as the prophet Jeremiah had promised, they were allowed to return. So they've resettled in Judah, and they've restored the temple, and now they've completed the great city walls around their historic and holy city, Jerusalem. And then chapters 11 and 12, which we're going to be looking at today in Nehemiah, give us just a glimpse of this magnificent moment of celebration and worship that includes thousands of musicians and singers. So today what we're going to do is we're going to do a drone flyover, just like we saw of that band, of this momentous occasion in the Bible and in the history of the Hebrew people. And then we're going to, like we always do, roll it up into like some practical takeaways that you and I can say, okay, this is what we can do with this scripture that we've looked at today. So, and then at the conclusion, most of you know this all. You guys remember Gangnam Style? Remember that? Our kids' choir is going to join us in Nehemiah style at the end for a celebration. So let's just take this drone look at chapters 11 and 12. Remember, the wall's completed, and so it's relatively safe for them to repopulate the region. And so it starts with a resettlement plan in chapters 11, verses 1. It goes from chapters 11:1 all the way through 12:26 is this plan. And it includes a plan to repopulate the city, and secondly, they make governance assignments. And 11:1 begins by describing how the city was repopulated. Lauren read this. Now the leaders of the people settled in Jerusalem, and the rest of the people cast lots to bring one out of every 10 of them to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while the remaining 9 were to stay in their own towns. So this plan to repopulate Jerusalem provides for the government officials to distribute themselves first. They get first choice. They probably had to do that because they needed to make it more convenient for them to be in their positions and to be present in the community so that they could do their jobs. But next, and there's a question about this, you can see that there's a lottery. There's a lottery in which 1 in 10 were made housing offers, either because more people wanted to move back into Jerusalem than they had spaces for, or it's possible that it was more like a draft designated to relocate. You know, 1 in 10 of you will move to the city. You know, it's kind of like you're going to be one of the ones that move. It's hard to tell from the text. But in the end, there's these options for how they live. They can live an urban, a suburban, or a rural lifestyle. And either way, it was an honor to be able to live within the city limits. In verse 2, the people commended all who volunteered to live in Jerusalem. And then in 11:3, it starts to provide these details of how the allotments, both in the city and the surrounding towns, were made. In chapter 11, there are parcels that are provided to civic people, to provincial leaders, I think your NIV says, who ran all the governmental agencies of the region in that area. And then there are religious parcels given to people who have these religious jobs. Of course, priests, but it includes temple staff, people who took care of the facilities, the outside of the grounds of the temple. And you can read through all this. We're not going to read it all today. There's judges and counselors who sit in what's the court of the Gentiles in the temple. That was a space where anybody could come, even if you weren't Jewish. There was a prayer director and a choir director assigned. And then in chapter 12, verses 1 through 36, we have even more allotments and more role assignments. Nehemiah is so meticulous in providing this information for us, and we see a variety of civic assignments. I'm going to put them up on the screen here and just read through them. There's a CFO that's designated. They district the city. They parcel it out. There are priests, including a head priest. There are temple logistics and a supervisor. It's what are called the men of standing. They're important people in the community. There's a service director, someone who produces the temple worship. There are musicians, a king's liaison, which they have to interact, remember, with the king of Persia, because they're under his rule. There are province supervisors, which are like county positions, representatives of families and tribes. So every family and tribe had people that were part of the governance of the region. There was an overall governor, and there was a primary spiritual director who we've already talked about, Ezra, who probably, most scholars believe, wrote both of these books, Ezra and Nehemiah. So even though that looked different, you know, in that context, you can see that just like today, it takes people and organization to run a city government, to have a community, and to have a religious life. So think about, just back off here, like I know it's a lot of information, but just back off and think about the big picture here, what has happened. The walls were completed all the way back in chapter 7 in our text here, but there was so much to do. To get organized before they held these city dedications with all these ribbon cuttings, you know, if they did that. They took a census so that they knew their demographic needs. They settled Jerusalem and the other towns. They didn't want to make the mistakes of the past, so they sought spiritual guidance through all of this. Remember, they humbly confessed their sins as a community. They made new covenants and new commitments, and now it's time to celebrate. Do you know what an ah moment is? Ah. He does. Like when the sermon's finally over, it's, ah, no. Like this summer, I redid my backyard, and when I say I basically did it all. And I dug out old plants. We'd been in that house for over 20 years, and you know, there were vines that took over everything. And you remember how hot it was in the summer? That's when I was doing it. And it was brutal, but that thing just hung over me. Every spare minute I had to be back there. And of course I told you about my crabgrass battle I had. And there is not a sprig of crabgrass in my lawn at this moment. It's getting ready to burst, I know. Just like sin in my life. But when I got all done with that, like when the, you know, it was all cleaned up, like I restained all my pavers and just everything looked so good. Cindy and I just went in the backyard and we sat in our patio furniture. We had a glass of wine and we're like, ah, oh, that's what I'm talking about. You know, ah is when the project is done. Ah is when your senior graduates and they're off to college. Ah is when you're done paying for college and you can finally spend some money on you and your home. Ah is when you finally close that deal that you've been working on for months or maybe even years. It's like, and it's signed, and you're like, ah, this is an ah moment. And so then, as we continue into chapter 12, now, in this ah moment, they have the dedication of the wall, Nehemiah 12, verses 27 through 43. The first thing they do is assemble musicians in an orchestra, in verse 27. At the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, the Levites were sought out from where they lived, and they were brought to Jerusalem to celebrate joyfully the dedication with songs of thanksgiving and with the music of cymbals, harps, and lyres. The Levites here mentioned are the Jewish tribe that are assigned to temple worship. Now, they're not all teachers and Bible scholars and theologians. Some of them are just, they're gifted musicians and vocalists. So they had a worship team. And this is no little affair, as I mentioned. It's huge. They gather musicians from all the surrounding Jewish communities. And the celebration begins with this really serious moment in verse 30 when the priests and Levites had purified themselves ceremonially. They purified the people, the gates, and the wall. Now, we don't know exactly what it means that they purified, they did these purifying ceremonies, but clearly they're beginning the celebration by squaring their hearts with God because they realize they cannot worship God authentically with impure hearts. And so this is not just a celebration and a party, but it is a party. But it's also a holy moment for them. And then see this picture in your mind. The city dignitaries and office holders, they distribute themselves upon the wall. And then Nehemiah sends two huge choirs to proceed to the top of the wall. Verse 31, Lauren read this. I had the leaders of Judah go up on top of the wall, and I also assigned two large choirs to give thanks. And then Nehemiah lists some of the other regional leaders and more musicians that are part of this group, and they distribute themselves on the wall in different directions. Verse 31, again, they signed two choirs to give thanks, and one was to proceed to the top of the wall to the right. And Ezra's with this first group. And then Nehemiah goes in the opposite direction with the other, verse 38. The second choir proceeded in the opposite direction. And I followed them on top of the wall together with half of the people. So they're just distributing all of the people on this wall. Now, to give you a sense of the magnitude of this scene, archaeologists have uncovered portions of Nehemiah's wall. And I'm going to put an image up on the screen right now so you can see. Can you see the gal on the top of it? This is how big this wall is. The walls are almost 40 feet high, and they're 8 feet wide at the top, and it's estimated this time probably about 2.5 miles in total in length. And the people here, they're described as spreading out on the wall to these various gates that are in the wall. So we're talking about vast space, 2.5 miles, spread out between the gates that are all mentioned. It's huge. It's Rockin' 1000 on steroids. Then after the celebration on the wall, the choirs and the priests make their way to the temple, and they continue to celebrate. Verse 40, the two choirs that gave thanks then took their places in the house of God. And so did I, together with half the officials as well as the priests. And everybody is feeling the joy. In verse 43, on that day they offered great sacrifices, rejoicing because God had given them great joy. And then it's mentioned that the women and children also rejoice. So everybody's part of this. That's why that's there. It's to tell you that everybody was a part of this. And they're not all standing on this wall, all stoic and reserved. Remember, they're standing on these walls that they rebuilt with their own hands. So they're having a ball. You guys, like, depending on where you live in the community, do you ever hear some of the high school football games going on from your house? Yeah. And you hear the band, you hear the drums, you can tell when your home team scores because it gets really loud. And when it's quiet, you know it's not going so good, right? The Israelite celebration was really loud. The sound of rejoicing in Jerusalem could be heard far away. And then the chapter ends with this indication of how their worship is genuine. This isn't just an emotional moment. There's the funding of the temple staff in verses 44 through 47. At the end of chapter 12, Nehemiah describes the financial support system that was put together to fund the temple. Verse 44, at that time, men were appointed to be in charge of the storerooms for the contributions, first fruits, and tithes. From the fields around the towns, they were to bring into the storerooms the portions required by the law for the priests and the Levites. For Judah was pleased with the ministering priests and Levites. So they're both grateful here and worshipful, but they're practical too. They're grateful to be free and to be in this moment of completion, the moment of awe and to worship, but they're also practical. And that they realize that in order to have this religious center of worship, it requires funding. So they establish a storeroom within the temple area for food and gifts and a safe place to keep the offerings, the money offerings. And then they assign business people to oversee its distribution. The people are grateful for their place of worship and for those that minister to them. So they give joyfully in verse 47. So in the days of Zerubbabel and of Nehemiah, all Israel contributed the daily portions for the musicians and the gatekeepers, and they also set aside a portion for the other Levites, and the Levites set aside a portion for the descendants of Aaron. So that's as far as we're going to go today. And as we wrap up here in the next few moments, I just want to give you a few things to think about that I think, you know, we can distill out of this passage. Maybe you've already thought of some of them yourself as we're going through. It's like, oh, I can see how that connects to me today. The first thing is that joy is cultivated in worship. Joy is cultivated in worship. Sometimes when it comes to joy, it appears there are two categories of Christians to me. One are the anti-joy people. You're against joy. Somewhere gloom and doom like a badge of sainthood. And for them, being unhappy and angry is a sign of their spirituality. Because they think, if you only knew what I know, then you wouldn't be happy. And then there's the other crowd who says, you always have to be joyful. You know, they're that, I'm just blessed, 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 you know, all the time. I'm always blessed. It's like foil on your teeth sometimes. It's a little too much, right? And you can never have a down day. And they're thinking because that makes you unspiritual. And sometimes people will say, choose joy. I mean, I love the t-shirt and the meme. And I get it. I definitely think having a positive can-do attitude is a great philosophy to live by. Proverbs 17:22 says, a cheerful heart is good medicine. But I don't think my capacity to be joyful is completely based on my mental discipline to choose joy. Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes that there's a season for everything, right? So it's not human or spiritual to just be joyful all the time. But according to Galatians 5:22, joy is a fruit of the Spirit. That is, joy comes from a right relationship with God, the kind of joy that we're talking about. That's why Paul wrote down this prayer for the Christians in Rome in Romans 15, 13. May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. God fills us with joy, and what comes out is hope, which are related, right? Joy and hope are connected. James says that we can even be joyful in hard circumstances. And I'll show you something interesting here in chapter 12 of Nehemiah, verse 43. It records, on that day they offered great sacrifices, rejoicing because God had given them great joy. You see, their joy came from their great accomplishment, right? But it was their recognition of God's intervention in their lives that like enables them to acknowledge it and notice it. But joy also comes through worship. In Nehemiah 12:27, at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, the Levites were sought out from where they lived, and they were brought to Jerusalem to celebrate joyfully the dedication with songs of thanksgiving and with the music of cymbals, harps, and lyres. You know, so we sang, 10,000 reasons today. And it's like, whether I'm up or down, I bless you, Lord. Bless the Lord, oh my soul. When we gather to worship, it's not just church or some songs, a kind of elderly guy up there babbling on for 30 minutes or so, some cute little kids. It's like we gather in thanksgiving, gratitude for what God is doing in our lives. And their celebration was prompted by gratitude, songs of thanksgiving. Remember, look where they started from. Exiled from their land, in captivity, their city in ruins. And look where they are now. Their city's rebuilt. They're settled in the land and able to worship again. And where does that joy come from? Gratitude. They take a moment and say, look at what you've done, God. Look at what we've accomplished because of your hand in our lives. And the Israelites got up on that wall that they had built with their own hands to worship with thankful hearts, because they knew they couldn't have done it without God's gracious hand upon them. Remember, this phrase appears 9 times in these 2 books, the gracious hand of God upon them. And they sang so loud that the sound of rejoicing in Jerusalem could be heard far away. Do you know what they sang? Let's stand and I'll lead you in the song. Everyone stand. This is your 7th inning stretch, by the way. I think you know the words. They come right out of the Holy Scriptures. There's a party going on right here, a celebration to last throughout the year. So bring your good times and your laughter too. We're gonna celebrate your party with you. Come on now.
Celebration.
Come on. Okay, you got it. Thank you. You can be seated. Great job. The new rockin' 300 or so. I don't know. Peter wrote in his first letter, chapter 1, verse 8, you believe in him and are filled with inexpressible and glorious joy. And it's good for all of us to stop and take note of God's intervention in our lives. Not just however many years it was ago when you first received Christ or were exposed to the gospel, but joyful, grateful worship. And most of all, to stop often to acknowledge God's grace on our lives, our day-to-day lives, and how his hand is upon us. Now, next, I want to point out, and this jumped off the page at me as I was reading through the list of the people that were involved in this special worship today, the thing that was going on. Then both Ezra and Nehemiah provide lists in both of their books. They provide these lists of people who returned, who built the wall, the key leaders, the priests, and the worship leaders. But then there are, as Nehemiah calls them, the rest of the people. The rest of the people, 11:1 again, Now, the leaders of the people settled in Jerusalem, and we have their names. The rest of the people, they cast lots to bring one out of every 10 of them to live in Jerusalem. The rest of the people. The rest of the people are the anonymous difference makers, the unsung heroes. They don't get a moment on the red carpet, and you won't see them on the highlight reel. The anonymous difference maker is a difference maker just the same. They just don't get the glory that some other people may. So this is your second takeaway. Unnoticed doesn't mean unimportant. Unnoticed doesn't mean unimportant. Let me give you an example. Who won the last Super Bowl, Super Bowl 58? Kansas City Chiefs, okay. Who was the Chiefs quarterback? Patrick Mahomes, okay. Who was his center? You know, the guy that made sure that he was protected and gave him the rock every play after play so that he could do his magic? Creed Humphrey. There he is. Creed Humphrey, all 6'4", 320 pounds. Creed Humphrey. You know, in football, the offensive line, they are the rest of the people. Any linemen in here going to give me a shout out? The first time I played organized football at our local Optimist Club in Carroll City, Miami, Florida, they made me a lineman. Mainly because I was a little bigger and I didn't have any physical talent. I just had anger. And so that was working out for me. And I learned, nobody cares who plays right guard. You know, it's the quarterback, the running backs, the receivers, they all get their names in the paper. They never say, and Sipe made some amazing blocks. So, I'd like to just name the offensive line from the Kansas City Chiefs Super Bowl championship team. There was center Creed Humphrey. At guards, they had Nick Allegretti, Trey Smith, Joe Thuney. At offensive tackles, they had Lucas Niang, Donovan Smith, and Jawan Taylor. And then some utility guys on the line, Mike Caliendo and Wanya Morris. So, does anyone think that the Kansas City Chiefs could have won a Super Bowl without an offensive line? No. Does anyone here think that Patrick Mahomes would be the star he is without an amazing offensive line? The anonymous difference makers. See, we love celebrity, and we love the people that their names are up in lights, but we should love them less. Do you know who's in our tech booth today? Andrew and Jacob and Bob. Do you know who's in our bridge builders class right now for special needs? Brett Griffin and Charlene Warner. Do you know who's with our middle school students right now? Craig and Julianne Winger. They're over there. Do you know who's teaching our second graders? I think it's Nate Thomas. Is it Nate? Okay. Yes? Do you know who made coffee for us today? Madison Calipo, right over here. Do you know who our facility staff is? The people that, like, set everything up and get us ready for Sunday, Greg Santos, Ed Catlett, Mike Bergner. All I'm saying is, we should be a lot better at recognizing people who are making a difference but aren't seen. But here's what I want you to notice, I want you to think about. If no one is noticing you right now, you think that they're not. It doesn't mean that what you're doing isn't extremely important, because God sees. Unnoticed is not important. Hebrews 6:10, God is not unjust. He will not forget your work and the love you have shown him as you have helped his people and continue to help them. Someone may notice, maybe not, along the way what you do, but don't forget about that day when you're going to be transported to the gates of heaven and Jesus is going to meet you there and he's going to say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Because that's the best. He's the one you really want to see. Most of us are ordinary people doing ordinary stuff, but unnoticed doesn't mean unimportant, because God's hand is upon you. And I want to say that to some of you here today, that you feel like you're in the rest of the people category. Mom and Dad, you're not getting the credit that you should get right now. Your kids, there's no way they can grasp what you're doing for them and that the sacrifice that you're making. If you're a single mom or dad, even more so. People have no idea how hard it is for you. If you're a student right now and you're trying to live for Christ, people like me who went to school in a whole different culture and time, you know, and we thought it was hard, we have no idea how hard it is for you today. If you're in a PTA or a school board member, no one knows how many hours that people don't see that you put in to make this community better, the way that you're giving yourself for our kids and our students and our community. Some of you are in a job right now where you feel underappreciated, or you know, you feel like it's a nowhere job and like you don't like it, you don't love it, but it pays the bills and you're providing for your family, but nobody knows what a struggle it is for you every Monday to get up and go to work. You know, there are big-time pastors who are on TV all the time. They get their names in the paper. They're very famous, usually when they fall, which is not good. And they get a lot of attention. But, you know, there are literally thousands of churches across this country of less than 100 where the pastor works a real job, you know, all during the week, just so that he can be there and keep that church going. And they're discipling people, and they're letting people come, they're leading people to Christ. They'll never write a book. They're not going to get invited to be the keynote speaker at some big conference, but they're shepherding a group of people, because unnoticed is not unimportant. And then last, I think what we can take away is there's a new way to shine the light, a new way to shine the light. The exiles are home in their holy city, Jerusalem. But it's different than it was before. Remember previously when the Israelites escaped from Egypt, the Exodus led them to a promised land of their own. They were a separate nation. They were a theocracy where they had their own values and their religion and traditions governed them. But this return and settling their land is not as a separate geo-religious entity. They're dwelling in a pagan land under pagan rule. And remember, Jerusalem is their model city. It's a representation of God. It's the city on the hill that shines the light. And it still is, but it's different now. God is not calling them to take the land by force, but they are to live within a foreign culture. And you know, Jesus personified the way to shine the light under Rome. They were not free, but yet he brought this new kingdom, this new way of thinking. And they shine the light in a different way. And the church today is the new Jerusalem. We are the city on a hill. The church is a light of the world. Yet I want to say that this day and time, God is not calling us to force our religion upon other people. It's not likely we're going to shine the light through power. Instead, now the light leaks through broken vessels, us, imperfect as we are. As a new Jerusalem, our light shines differently. Paul said things like in 1 Thessalonians 4:11, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. You should mind your own business and work with your hands, just as we told you, so that your daily life may win the respect of outsiders. It's different, but we're called to shine the light. How will people know we're his disciples? What did Jesus say? By our what? Our love one for another. We are called to shine the light in what can sometimes be a dark world. But basically it comes down to doing good and being kind to people. As Micah said, to love mercy, to do justly, and to walk humbly. It's a new way to shine the light. I'm going to ask the band and our kids choir to come up right now. And while they do, I just want to say that there are so many parallels from this thing that happened 2,500 years ago. Number one, a church that worships in joy, a church that gathers in gratitude for what God is doing in our lives, a joyful church, their voice will be heard from far away. It's apparent that God's hand is upon that kind of a church. It doesn't matter if we get all of our accolades or props that we think we deserve. If we see God's hand upon us, then that's enough. Unnoticed is not unimportant. And shining the light today doesn't require a big spotlight or a superstar. Mainly, the church today is just hundreds of flashlights. You know, we kind of get our batteries charged up and then we go out into our community and shine the light.
Hey everybody, it's Britt again. Thanks for listening. If you need something, if you have a question, or you'd just like us to pray for you, you can reach us through email, info@sunridgechurch.org. We hope you'll listen in again next week, but in the meantime, keep helping people find and follow Jesus.